Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You had one job, state legislature, write a budget. Actually, you had two jobs, write a budget and fully fund education. You didn't do either one of them, so now we're paying for yet another special session beginning today. Reporter Austin Jenkins covers Olympia for KUOW. Welcome back, Austin.
Good afternoon, Bill. Great to be here.
Why could the legislature not get those two things done?
Well, in a word, it's because we have divided government in this state. House Democrats and Senate Republicans, and very different views and philosophies of how to get those two jobs you just described completed.
The legislature has a deadline. Will you remind us briefly why the state Supreme Court gave that legislature a deadline?
Right. Well, in the McCleary school funding case, which dates back to 2012, the deadline that the court has imposed is September 1st, 2018, to fully implement a program of basic education in this state that, to quote the Constitution, makes ample provision for the education of all children residing within its borders.
Ample provision. What's ample mean?
Well, I suppose that is in the eye of the beholder, except that the court has explained in writing what it thinks that means. And really what it did in the court ruling back in 2012 is say to the legislature, you have already defined in statute what a basic education is. So that's the template. Now you just need to fund it. Years have gone by since then, but in essence, the court used what the legislature had already done against the legislature. So you've defined it. You've said what this means. Now you got to pony up the money.
You haven't lived up to the standards that you agreed to live up to.
Correct.
And what about basic education? What are we talking about? I mean, does that include arts teachers or music teachers or after-school programs? Or what, can you give us the thumbnail on that?
Well, the thumbnail is in current statute, they talk about a prototypical school. It's kind of Olympia speak for what the typical school might include in terms of counselors and librarians and teacher-to-student ratios. The Senate Republicans, interestingly, would actually like to throw out that model, and their proposal is to adopt a per-pupil student funded model. And so each student would get a dollar amount that goes with them. And then students who have extra needs, perhaps a special needs child, a homeless child, would get extra money that goes with them. That's an approach that they think the public would understand better. There's pushback, and there are arguments that are offered for why that's not a good idea. But what the court is saying is that the local school levies now are paying for things that are clearly within the basic education basket. And those would be things like the cost to hire and retain teachers and staff. That is basic education. That's being paid for right now by local school levies.
I've lived in other states. I don't remember having this conversation about their state Supreme Courts holding legislatures in contempt of court for not fully funding education. Is our Washington state constitution unique in this?
We're unique in terms of that word paramount. The only other state that I could find that uses that term is Florida, where the Constitution there says the education of children is a fundamental value of the people of the state of Florida. It is therefore a paramount duty of the state. But there are similar lawsuits that have been in play in states like Kansas and New Jersey, where the language in the constitutions doesn't seem nearly as strong, and yet the courts have concluded in very similar fashion that the state is not getting the job done. So we may be unique in having very strong language about this being the paramount duty. We're not unique among states in terms of a Supreme Court case and a Supreme Court order that the legislature do something more for school kids.
What happens if the legislature, again, can't get to a deal this year before the deadline comes?
Well, even if they do get to a deal, the court will have the final say in weighing in and whether what they did was sufficient and enough. If they can't get to a deal, and I don't think anybody is yet throwing in the towel and expecting that that's what's going to happen. It's a question of how long will it take to get to a deal. Then you're in a situation where the legislature has promised to act this year. They've promised to do something. This is the deadline to act because, again, next fall is when the program has to be fully implemented. So you got to pass it now to get it going. So lawmakers know this. They know that they have this responsibility. They have in statute said that they will act this year. But when that's going to be, we don't know.
What do you think is going to happen, Austin?
Well, my gut, based on past experience, would be that they'll get a deal by June 30th because that's the end of the fiscal year. But it feels different this year than it has in past years. You know, they haven't gotten out on time in a budget year since 2009. So we're not, these extra sessions are not unusual. But there's a lot of acrimony right now in this state capitol. There is, the partisan divide is fierce. There was the Senate Republicans forced some Democratic-backed tax proposals to the floor on Friday, and that created some new and fresh acrimony. The two sides are not even sitting down at the negotiating table to talk about a budget. There are some education funding task force meetings going on, but it feels like this is a fairly dysfunctional situation right now. Whether they can move past that in the coming days and weeks, maybe so. But June 30th will be here pretty quick, and this is a big lift for them to do in a pretty short amount of time.
My guest has been Austin Jenkins' gut and his and his knowledge and his skill. Reporter Austin Jenkins covers Olympia for you on KUOW. Good to talk with you again. We'll watch along with you, Austin. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
KUOW's The Record. More in a moment. So over the weekend, many scientists took to city streets across the country, in fact, to celebrate and defend their work. The March for Science was organized in the face of the Trump administration's proposal to cut billions in funding for scientific research. Among those marching were scientists whose work is now in limbo while they're waiting for the new budget. EarthFix reporter Cassandra Profita brings us one of their stories from Vancouver, Washington.
Eric Dexter pulls a giant windsock out of a plastic tub and dips it into the Columbia River.
So now we're going to catch the zooplankton samples.
He's looking for invasive species, but not the kind you usually hear about. Invasive plankton are practically invisible. They come in the ballast water of cargo ships, often from Asia. To even find these microscopic organisms, you need a plankton fishing net.
It's made out of a really, really fine fabric. The holes in it are about 75 microns, so a lot smaller than the width of human hair.
As a PhD student at Washington State University, Dexter maintains the only continuous record of Columbia River plankton. Every month, he gets a check from the Environmental Protection Agency's STAR Fellowship Program. The agency pays for his living expenses and the costs of his research. But these days, he never knows whether his check is going to show up.
As far as I can tell, I will find out if it's been canceled when my paycheck stops arriving.
He's gotten just one email from the EPA since President Donald Trump took office. It said no one knew whether his fellowship would be frozen during the grant freeze back in January. And that's the last he heard. Then, last month, a leaked document revealed details of Trump's federal budget proposal.
The only information I have is these leaked documents, but those documents are pretty clear.
The administration wants to cut EPA funding by 31%, slashing a quarter of the staff and eliminating dozens of programs, including the fellowship that pays Dexter's bills.
The entire program has been slated to be deleted.
So now he waits and continues to worry that he might not have income to do his research and pay his mortgage. The people he knows who work at the EPA are living in a similar state of uncertainty.
Everybody goes to work knowing that that might be their last day at work. Everybody is afraid they could be fired at any moment.
The EPA declined an interview request and responded to questions with a statement. It says, while many in Washington insist on greater spending, the EPA is focused on great value and results. The EPA will partner with states to ensure a thoughtful approach is used to maximize every dollar to protect air, land, and water.
I think that most scientists are facing possible cuts.
Scott Black is an ecologist and the director of the Xerces Society in Portland, one of the sponsors of the March for Science.
It's making a lot of us nervous because nobody knows whether it's going to be them, whether it's going to be somebody else, whether it's going to be everybody.
He's hoping the march will push members of Congress to minimize the cuts to scientific research as lawmakers hash out the federal budget.
I don't think it's going to be as dire as is proposed. That said, it's going to be a rollback, and I think that scientists at universities, conservation organizations, scientists at any research institution are all going to feel this.
He says the war on science didn't start with the Trump administration, but the election has rallied scientists to stand up and fight for their profession.
I've never seen anything like this, and I've been doing this work for 30 years. This isn't what we normally do, is talk about how important science is, but now's the time to do it.
And so now I'll zoom in. We'll double the magnification again.
Back in his lab, Dexter shows me an invasive plankton species that's taking over the Columbia every summer. He worries that it could wipe out the food supply for salmon. To the naked eye, it looks like a puddle of dirty water. But under a microscope,
a lot of what looked like just little bits of debris are actually little organisms. Every single organism under the microscope here is invasive.
Dexter says it's the equivalent of looking at a huge valley and seeing only invasive blackberry bushes. And it's scary, because nobody really knows the consequences of a microscopic invasion. But even scarier for Dexter is that soon there may not be any funding for scientists to study it. I'm Cassandra Profita, reporting.
I think you will enjoy KOW's photos of the Seattle March for Science on Saturday. If I were more STEM savvy than I am, I would understand signs like, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the precipitate. And it's so bad, even observationists are here. Science humor on our homepage, KOW.org. Nine people are now running for mayor of Seattle, and the Seattle business community doesn't really want to vote for any of them. Puget Sound Business Journal Editor-in-Chief Emily Parkhurst tells you why.
The business community is certainly not excited about any of the candidates on the ballot right now, from what I understand. We did a poll here at the Business Journal, and right now about 44% of those who have responded to our poll say that they favor Mike McGinn over everybody else. Ed Murray is next at 32%. And neither of those is, you know, a real wide margin, obviously. Mm-hmm. The business community is kind of torn. I think that Ed Murray is not somebody that they're rallying behind in any way, shape, or form, and they weren't before the sexual assault scandal.
Why is that?
This was, you know, I think basically they felt like there was this very big distance between what Murray was trying to do and what the business community was hoping that he would do. I think there's also this feeling that, you know, he's not rallying Seattle and creating this, like, let's sell Seattle for what it's worth, for everything that it is, and really get the message out there that this is a great place for businesses to come and do business. Instead, you know, he has focused on income inequality, and I think that that's good, and I think the business community supports that. But their concerns have been that it hasn't been balanced. It has not been a conversation with the business community. And I think there's a lot of unintended consequences to some of the things that have been pushed through that could have been avoided if the business community had been engaged.
You haven't yet used the term overregulation, Emily, and I've been expecting it. That's a huge concern, isn't it?
It is. It is. You know, I think the best argument that I heard from some business folks about overregulation comes from the restaurant industry. And I think, you know, there's probably a lot of your listeners who are going to roll their eyes and say, yeah, the wealthy restaurateurs in the city are doing very well. And that's true. But we have now passed about, I think it's four major regulations that go after the restaurant industry. And I think their big concern is that we don't know which ones are working and which ones are not, because they all went into effect at the same time. So we can't tell if the minimum wage is going to have a negative impact on the restaurant community, because we've also passed three other laws that are going to impact that same group. So it's really hard to tell what's working, what's not, what's going to affect jobs, what isn't. And I think they would have liked to have seen this rolled in a little more staggered.
What about taxation? Sometimes we publicly negotiate saying we want less taxation, but do you think Seattle businesses truly feel unfairly taxed by Mayor Murray?
I don't know that it's unfairly taxed. I think the proposal to tax the wealthy that he mentioned is definitely going to have a lot of our readers concerned.
This proposed city income tax that many candidates
are... The city income tax,
packing.
Exactly. Exactly. Although, you know, when I talk to some folks in the business community, there's a lot of people who support a state income tax. And I think that they see the value of that. That's certainly not true across the board. By any means, it's pretty divided. But there is some support for that. And I think there's some understanding that the business community needs to shoulder some of this burden. I think what they're concerned about is shouldering that burden at the same time as dealing with, you know, very difficult regulations that in some cases are being challenged in court because they believe that they're not legal. And so that's a big distraction for the city, and it could be a real problem for the business community.
How do you think the average Seattle resident sees the effect of all the business regulations the city's passed?
I think it's probably mixed. I think that there's definitely support for the minimum wage, and I think there's support for the minimum wage rise throughout the business community. I think that there are some other regulations, though, that have been, they've really not been good for the business community. The secure scheduling law, I think folks felt like that was not negotiated well and that the outcome is not going to be good for the employees or the employers, and that nobody won with that one.
Secure scheduling meaning making businesses give their employees more notice, for example, about openings and closings and shifts.
Right, exactly. There are some aspects of that law that are completely reasonable and fine, and some aspects of it, you know, like if employees decide they want to switch shifts, for example, the employer must pay them time and a half, even if it was the employee's idea to switch the shifts and wanted to do that. So they have to pay them time and a half, and you know, those kinds of rules, when put in place, could really have a huge impact on a smaller operation. You know, the Tom Douglases of the world are probably not going to feel that in any kind of major way. Or if they do, their margins are big enough that they can handle it. But some of these smaller restaurants, that could be a major issue for them.
So it sounds, Emily, like you're saying overall Seattle businesses favor Mike McGinn and Ed Murray, but reluctantly so. What do you think happens next?
I think the business community right now is really hoping somebody else throws their hat in the ring. Mm-hmm. If I'm honest, I don't know that anybody's excited about any of our options right now. And I think that there's, you know, I've heard some folks say they're hopeful that Bruce Harrell would throw his hat into the ring.
City council president.
Yeah, the city council president. I think that he would have some support from the business community. You know, he's in a tricky spot, of course, too, though, if he were to do that. And Murray were to stay in the race, that puts him in kind of at odds with Murray, and I could completely understand why he wouldn't necessarily want to do that. But I think that there is support in the business community for him.
Is the Seattle business community just never going to love anybody who would be elected mayor in Seattle, Washington?
No, I don't think that's true at all. I think we've had some mayors in the past, Norm Rice, for example, who have been incredibly popular with the business community. And I don't think that this needs to be a zero-sum game either. You know, I think that there could be some really fantastic folks who could satisfy this feeling that we need to work on income inequality and bring the business community into that discussion to really do this as a partnership instead of what it feels like now, where the two groups are basically at odds and kind of fighting over the future of the city. And it just doesn't feel like it's a productive way to go about this.
That's the view of Seattle's business community as reported by Emily Parkhurst, editor-in-chief of the Puget Sound Business Journal. Always good to talk with you. Thanks for laying this out for us, Emily.
Thank you, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Here, our local economy is booming with new employees in high-paying computer programming and engineering jobs, and many of those workers were not born in the United States. They came here on H-1B visas. It's a program that lets companies temporarily hire foreign workers, mostly in the tech industry. It's been around for years. Last week, President Trump signed an executive order that could mean big changes for the H-1B program. The White House says it will award visas to the most skilled or highest paid workers. Right now, visas are awarded through a lottery system. Seattle-based immigration lawyer Tamina Watson and aerospace labor union representative Stan Sorcher have different concerns about the program, but they'd both like to see that lottery system go. Here's why Stan Sorcher feels that way.
We've advocated for that for a long time. The issue that we have with the H-1B visa program is that it gives a lot of power to the employees, market power, bargaining power, leverage over the employees. And both the foreign and the U.S. worker wind up with less bargaining power in the labor market. So one way to give workers more leverage is to have an auction of the H-1B visas where there's a limited number of visas and a lot of employers wanting them. So you give the first visa to the employer who offers the highest salary, and continue until the limited number of visas are taken up.
Tamina, what's your take on scrapping the lottery system? And yes, it's unsure still what's going to happen.
Everybody would be happy not to have a lottery so that there is there is certainty in what your application is going to get. It's a very costly process for an employer to file an application and then not get selected. It also affects their businesses because they cannot plan. And the employee who is trying to get an H-1B because their status depends on it, they cannot make any decisions about what to do in the future. So the lottery does have to go. But how it's going to play out is going to be interesting to see.
Tamina, you've said this executive order could, we don't know, but it could have the opposite effect intended, meaning it's not going to get companies to hire American. What do you mean by that?
If the administrative changes bring a lot of restrictions, what employers will likely do is go to countries and locations where it's easier to hire employees to run their businesses. Ultimately,
go to those countries so you don't have to bring them into the United States?
Well, I think there are countries that welcome immigrants and high-skilled workers, and you only need to look at Canada. Everything that we do, they look at that and do the opposite.
Stan, what do you say about that? Companies, American companies can just go abroad,
sure,
go to Canada.
Go to Canada. There are so many political conversations in the United States that start with, well, in Canada. Uh-huh. And in fact, the Canadians don't really have a program like the H-1B. When they welcome immigrants, they're welcoming immigrants. Again, one of the things we're concerned about with the Trump executive order is that we certainly don't want this to turn into an anti-immigrant thing. And the Canadian public policy is to welcome immigrants. One of the problems with globalization is the feel that it's a race to the bottom. If the Canadians can lead us to a race to higher standards, I think that would be a positive for us. There are so many petitions for H-1B visas already. There will be plenty of employers in the United States looking for H-1B visas, with or without whatever happens in Canada.
So, but the concern that this executive order is trying to address is really looking at the tech industry specifically. You know, when they are looking at the types of visas and the people who are getting these H-1Bs, the administration is focusing not on the visas that are given out by universities or the nonprofit. They're really saying, hey, you know, these tech companies are taking all the jobs. But the reality is, just like Stan said, H-1B visas are used in the education industry, they're used in the health industry, mm-hmm. they are used in a multiple type of industries, in fact, all the industries, actually. But it's singling out the technology industry, and right. that is the wrong approach to take.
Well, but behind all of this is tech companies saying there are not enough American workers to fill these jobs. Stan, what do you say to that?
The original public policy purpose for the H-1B program was just that, that there seemed to be a labor shortage. So that was, let's say, 1990 was when the program in its more or less current form began. To have a labor shortage that lasts for 25 years means that you've either misunderstood something or you have some terrible, terrible design. When we talk in public about this, I get two reactions. One is the employers say, I can't find anybody. And then if there are any parents in the room, they say, my kid graduated with a 4.0 from a great university. He's been living in my basement for 14 months. So somewhere in between, I think, is the truth. There was a spirit among employers when I was young, many years ago, that you would hire somebody who was able to do the job. Somebody, that's what qualified meant. And then there was a period of on-the-job training, and some jobs it was a month, and some jobs it was years, and that was part of the employment relationship. As the employment relationship has frayed significantly, now we're looking for somebody who can hit the ground running. Well, I think that's, you should pay a premium for somebody who can hit the ground running. And if you're looking for somebody at an entry-level wage who can hit the ground running, you're going to have trouble finding them.
Tamina, what do you think of that claim? There aren't enough American workers for these tech jobs.
Well, what was right about what Stan said is this law was created in 1990. And the world has changed several times over. So at the technology industry, for example, the technology revolution, if you like, has changed the way businesses operate with the work that needs to happen. You can now operate a business in Timbuktu from a garage. You know, the modern technology has made the world smaller, and the way businesses operate are very different to how it used to be in 1990. So all immigration advocates, people who are using the immigration process to help their businesses, agree that the system needs to be modernized. But the question is there a lack of workers? And the answer is actually yes, because you have to look at the type of worker you're trying to fill these positions with. And when you ask an employer, is there a shortage of workers, they will say yes, because I'm looking for a specific STEM graduate to take these jobs.
STEM meaning science, technology, engineering, math.
That's correct, yes. And there is a lack of STEM graduates that are coming from US in general.
I was at a conference and I was listening to a panel of entrepreneurs, and they said how they couldn't find qualified U.S. workers. And in the question period, I asked one of them, well, this is several years ago when there really was high unemployment. I said, would you look at an application from somebody who'd been out of work for 6 months? He said, well, you know, that's not good. And I said, what about somebody who's over 45 years old? Well, we're looking for younger people. And one of the entrepreneurs was a physicist. And I said, would you have hired yourself if you had looked at your own resume? And he said, well, probably not.
And you think tech companies are being too picky?
They're being too picky. They can be picky. And why wouldn't you be picky if you can?
Tamina, do you accept, for better or for worse, do you believe that the H-1B visa program, as it's been running so far, reduces wages and or takes jobs from American citizens?
I do not. I think it has the opposite effect, actually. H-1Bs have a multiplier effect. For every one H-1B, five new positions are actually created. That person who was on an H-1B will need a doctor, an accountant, and sort of non-STEM sort of positions. In terms of wages, it has actually, there is research and reports to show that H-1B actually has the effect of increasing U.S. wages.
Stan, what's your ideal vision of how sometimes American companies want to bring in people from overseas?
Sure.
How do you think it should happen?
I would give the control over the visa to the worker so that the H-1B worker can operate in the labor market just like I do. I would expect employers to sponsor their temporary workers for permanent status. Also, I would do what Canada does and say, we're going to measure the labor market to see where there are legitimate shortages so we can do a good job of managing the public policies for legitimate concerns of employers. And that's what we should be doing for our families and the foreign workers and the U.S. workers.
Tamina, what's your vision?
I would look for comprehensive immigration reform. For H-1Bs, I would look to move students out of the H-1B program and give them a green card as they graduate, whether it's from a master's program or a PhD program. I would take the startup founders out of the H-1B program and thereby making space in the numbers that we have for people who have the skilled skills that we need for businesses. But at the same time, make sure that our immigration system is modernized for a modern world that we live in.
Seattle immigration lawyer Tamina Watson, founder of Watson Immigration Law, and Stan Sorcher is a labor representative with the aerospace union SPEA. Again, President Trump has told federal agency leaders to suggest reforms that would ensure H-1B visas go to the most skilled or highest paid applicants instead of the lottery system that our local tech businesses are used to dealing with. KUOW's The Record, thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. Yesterday morning, a group of whale watchers near Whidbey Island watched something they didn't pay for.
Oh no!
He ran over it.
He ran right over it.
No. I have it on video.
What an idiot!
He just hit that whale.
Yes,
a boat ran into a gray whale, wounding the animal and nearly crashing. The whale that was hit might be a local celebrity known as Patch, who's been traveling to Puget Sound with other gray whales since at least the early 90s. I asked the head of the Northwest Maritime Center, Jake Beatty, how often boats hit whales like this.
They're both not common and more common than we think. There's actually a record of ship strikes for more open ocean and larger ships. It's more rare in inland waters and especially in daylight hours.
What was that boater doing wrong?
If I was to boil it down to a single word, it would be vigilance. The main way one stays safe for and keeps everyone around them safe on the water is by being vigilant and paying attention to what you were doing and what you're both doing, but also looking for things that don't quite make sense. Something that looks like a log but isn't. Often also around whales, there's crowds of boats that are there or at least other boats that are there to observe these noble creatures, and when you see that, it's generally an indication that there are charismatic megafauna in the area, and these whales, you really need to slow down for them.
Yeah, I think the video is taken from a whale-watching boat, wasn't it?
That's correct, yeah, one of the clipper ships.
So you could see whale-watching boats and figure there's probably whales nearby.
Yeah, especially so all those Victoria Clipper and the sister ships, they travel at like 35, 40 knots, and to see them standing still is an indication that things are a little bit different.
Should we also give any responsibility to whale-watching boats? Do they in any way endanger whales and make a collision more likely?
You know, there has been a lot of people smarter than I looking at that situation, and there are certainly organizations that deploy sort of whale watcher watchers. So the sound keepers or the whale museum up in Friday Harbor have vessels they employ to make sure that the whale watchers are being safe and that the boats around them are being safe. This is a little farther south in their sort of area of operations usually, and it's usually a little earlier in the season than they operate as well, is my understanding. I know there's also risks to whales that other scientists are studying around sort of the sonic pollution that boat noise makes, and so there's other threats to the whale population other than just people watching them, but certainly those are under study.
How badly do you think that collision hurt this gray whale?
You know, that's another one that someone smarter than me is going to have to answer, but if you think about a 4,000 to 6,000 pound boat doing 20 to 25 miles an hour, I mean, think of an SUV that grazes, even a glancing blow to your spinal column, and it probably wouldn't feel too good.
The hopeful part of me thought, well, it didn't look like collision really so much as like it's surfed over it. I bounced over that thing, that whale.
I would like to share your optimism, but I truly don't know.
Do you think there'll be any penalty for the boater who hit the whale?
You know, I looked into that. I couldn't find a penalty for hitting a whale. You know, Washington State in 2008 imposed a 200-yard exclusionary zone around marine mammals, specifically whales. And there is a fine structure, $500 to $1,000 for encroaching that zone. I didn't find anything that was an increased penalty for actually hitting one.
Okay, well, Jake, I'm sorry that we seem to only talk when there are maritime collisions. Last time we talked, it was a boat. Remember the boat Naptime hit a state ferry?
I do. I do indeed. Hopefully this boat wasn't called Captain Ahab or something.
Any similarities there? Any overarching advice for boaters listening?
The common thread between Naptime hitting the ferry and this vessel hitting the boat is that vigilance. On Naptime, the boat that hit the ferry, the guy was down below in a head using answering the call of nature. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the story was in this. It's less clear. At least the story hasn't come out yet. But clearly, if they had been paying closer attention to either anomalies in sort of the wave pattern or the ripples or the calm spots in the water or the boats that are in the area, they probably would have slowed down. They probably could have avoided a collision. I will add on a good note, there are groups of people, especially the commercial fishing fleet, are looking into how to better avoid whales. So the longline fishermen in Alaska actually about 10 years ago entered into an avoidance study around how do they make sure they're not setting their gear or their boats in a way that harms sperm whales. And so at least there are in the more professional areas of the industry, proactive efforts into how to make sure we can coexist with the largest mammals.
Jake Beatty is executive director of the Northwest Maritime Center. By the way, authorities say they know who the boat driver is, and they say he's cooperating with the investigation. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. 2 years ago, an interview with the president of the NAACP in Spokane went global.
This man right here is your father? Right there?
Do you have a question about that?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. I was wondering if if your dad really is an African-American man.
That's a very... I don't know what you're implying.
Are you African-American?
I don't understand the question of... I did tell you that, yes, that's my dad. And he was unable to come in January.
Are your parents... they white?
Rachel Dolezal would acknowledge that she identifies as a black woman, but that biologically she is Caucasian. And since that was revealed, she's gotten a lot of attention. She's given many interviews explaining her take on racism and identity. She's published a book. For reasons you're about to hear, Seattle writer Ijeoma Oluo has wanted nothing to do with Rachel Dolezal. But then one of her editors, Charles Mudere at The Stranger, asked Ijeoma to go to Spokane, spend the day with Rachel Dolezal at her house and interview her. Ijeoma says that unwanted pitch came to her at just the right time.
I was having a day where I was really incredibly frustrated with the story as it was, and it had just been announced that she had changed her name to Nkechi, which is my sister's name. And that kind of like, that hit in a really raw place, especially because my sister lives in Nigeria and has her whole life. And she lives the honest truth of Nigeria. She lives under, you know, the violence and the fear and the instability. There's no jobs. You know, it's a basic police state in the area that she's at. Our father's tomb was burned to the ground a couple of years ago. She lives in that every day. And then this white woman changed her name to my sister's name because she thought it would make it easier for her to get a job. And it was
because
just,
Rachel Dolezal is such a toxic name.
Yeah. Which, by the way, is just the worst logic anyways. It makes no sense. You don't change your name to Nkechi to make it easier to get a job.
And in Spokane or anyplace else
yeah,
in America.
Yeah. I've lived with the name Ijeoma, which is actually easier than Nkechi. And I know it does not make it easier to get a job. And also, it's not as if people are going to be any more put at ease when a white woman shows up to an interview named Nkechi. But I was really frustrated, like, that day. And it had just interrupted even more of my life. I was getting ready for an event. My phone had this alert, and right as I was getting up to speak, like, my phone buzzes with this name change. So I got called at the right time. And then the other reason why I said it is because Charles Mudere asked me to.
And your editor at The Stranger.
Yes. And he is an amazing editor, and I really wish Seattle appreciated him more, because he is a man of uncommon talent in this city and really underrated, and especially as an editor. And I trust him. And he's the only black editor I've had the pleasure of working with for probably about 2 years now. And he saw something there and I couldn't see it, but I trusted him. And so I decided to take the leap.
Given all that, what did you ask Rachel Dolezal?
You know, what I tried to ask her, in all honesty, was I did a lot of research and I read her book and I watched a lot of interviews. And I basically asked the questions that Black America has been shouting at their television screen every time she gets on there that aren't being asked. And if they are being asked, she was able to kind of evade it without answering, and nobody pushed further. And watching it, I realized she's managed to avoid any of these really difficult questions while also claiming to be an expert on these subjects.
And so, the Black history professor.
Exactly. And so basically, I just, you know, I took all of the questions that I've always had in my head that other people have had in their heads, other Black people have had in their heads, and I just came with those. And I thought maybe if I'm sitting in her living room, it'll go differently. Maybe it'll be a little bit harder for her to avoid answering them.
And what did you learn?
I was actually a little surprised, and I don't think I would have been able to write an essay if I wasn't. If I just came and it confirmed what I had suspected, it wouldn't have been worth it for me or I think anyone else. I had suspected to find just, you know, a nice white lady who really loved black people a bunch and just took it a little too far. And, you know, I am a mixed race black woman with a white mom who, when I was born, lived with, you know, hundreds of Nigerians in this apartment complex that for some reason only Nigerians lived in. And she loved it, you know, and she dressed up in, you know, the traditional clothing, learned how to cook the food. And I thought maybe if, like, my mom had kind of lost a grip with reality. This is what Rachel Dolezal would be. You know, like, mm-hmm. I really actually came, as frustrated as I was with the concept and the discussion, I came with a pretty sympathetic view towards her as a person because of that history. And I thought, maybe that's just what it is. Maybe she just doesn't quite get it. And I actually left thinking, no, this is someone who has decided that blackness is hers and that she can do it better. And I really left feeling, I mean, almost from about 10 minutes in, she doesn't like actual black people and she doesn't like being challenged by black people. And she gets very defensive about it and really feels like, how dare you? You know, I've done all this for you.
I want to understand that, because even if she is wrongheaded, yeah. a listener might ask, how can you say she doesn't like black people?
Yeah.
I mean, she has devoted her life to trying to understand the black experience and do some healing.
Yeah, you know, I think like what a lot of people may not understand, and I think a lot of people in communities of color know, there's the concept of the white savior. There's the person who comes to save you. And they say they're doing it out of love, but they're really doing it out of a sense of self-importance and a sense of superiority. I am doing this for you because you can't do it for yourself. And even if you, you know, read her book, which, I mean, I don't, it may not be worth it to read the book. It's a really bad book. But she talks at length about, you know, listing every tiny thing she's ever done for black people, but at the same time talks about black human beings in a very dismissive and condescending tone. So she will talk about, and she did this in person with me a couple of times. She's done this in other interviews. She basically writes off black people who don't accept her as people who haven't read up enough on race theory. They just don't know. They're uneducated and they don't want to know. Like she actually said, you know, they haven't read those books and they probably never will. She talks about how she's going to South Africa to start her book tour because South Africans are just more evolved on race than black Americans are, which is an absolutely insulting, you know, thing to say, not only for black Americans, but it's also an erasure of how incredibly horrific race relations happen to be in South Africa right now. You know, she talks about in her book about a light-skinned woman who was hard on her in an interview, and she said she's obviously trying to prove her blackness to darker-skinned people. Then she talks about dark-skinned black women saying they're trying to feel better about themselves and increase their self-esteem by making her look bad. I mean, if you read through the entire thing, she talks about divorcing her husband, and one of the reasons why they got a divorce was because he wasn't quote-unquote black enough. This is a man who's been black his entire life, and she was blacker than him, and he resented it. This is what she says. It's incredibly insulting. And when you're sitting with her and talking with her, you get that very much that same vibe. Oh, you just don't know. You just aren't smart enough.
We're talking about the interview that our guest Ijeoma Oluo did in the house of Rachel Dolezal in Spokane. And you talked about, you said you asked the questions that Black America has been shouting. And most Black Americans might agree with you, I don't know. At least a few rich, famous Black Americans have supported her. This is Rihanna talking about Rachel Dolezal. I think she was a bit of a hero because she flipped on society. Is it such a horrible thing that she pretended to be black? Black is a great thing, and I think she legit changed people's perspectives a bit and woke people up.
Yeah, you know what was interesting is I think partially when Rihanna said that, that was closer towards the beginning of this entire scandal, and I don't know if she saw or a lot of people saw that basically what we've had for the last 2 years is discussions on black female identity surrounding a white woman. And I don't know if people understand how painful that is. Black women are so invisible. And if you look at the state of black women, it didn't increase discussions about why black women account for half of all murders of women in the U.S., even though we're only about, 8% of the population. Nobody asks about why so many of us, 60,000+ of us, are missing right now. Nobody didn't increase any of that discussion about why we have one of the highest, you know, infant mortality rates and death in childbirth. Nobody asked any of these questions. Why
this didn't strike a blow for awareness or colorblindness or anything.
No, all it did is it changed the discussion to whether or not a white woman could be us, a white woman who will never, ever have to suffer the way we have. In fact, it sucked up all of the conversation about black female identity and turned it into, oh, well, if you believe in this, you should welcome this woman. Oh, you know, what about Rachel Dolezal? And we've still been suffering in silence. We've been dying. We've been abused. We've been murdered. And nobody has cared. And to see that, you know, I don't think anyone who really cares about Black women can look at these last 2 years and say that this conversation has done anything to benefit us. All it has done is erase us.
So to this idea, and as you know, this is very common among well-meaning white people, that let's say, Ijeoma, that you would like a future where people are not stuck being Black or white. If Rachel Dolezal's attempt was a terrible idea, what is a good idea?
A good idea is to try and tear down the actual system itself within your privilege. It does mean no good to have a white person become Black and become basically just as powerless as I am to change the system. You work within your privilege. It, you know, I wish that was something that a lot of allies and white people who really care understood. People avoid recognizing how much privilege they have because it makes them feel bad and it makes them feel guilty. It makes them feel like maybe they haven't earned everything they have. And I get that feeling because we all have privilege. I have privilege in many different ways as well. But the truth is that where you have privilege, you also have power to change the system, right? I don't have, like, Bill, you are a white man. You have so much more access, even having this show, right? And helping decide what gets discussed and what doesn't, what voices you bring on, right? Who your team is, who you hire. You have a huge amount of power. And that can make you feel bad if you realize how much less power people have. But also, that means every day you come to work with an opportunity to change that system and pull it apart piece by piece. Because I can't suddenly decide I want a radio show and make that happen, right? Yeah. And if you decided, no, I'm just going to give that up and I'm going to show solidarity by pretending like I have as much power as Black people, you just create an empty chair for another white person to sit in and not care. But every day you wake up with opportunities to elevate people and help people from your position. And that is where I wish people would understand. It doesn't help me to have someone come and sit next to me and be just as handcuffed as I am. It helps me if people take the power they have and use it for good.
You've said that it's white supremacy that has decided Rachel Dolezal was newsworthy, including the fact that you were assigned to it. First of all, what does your assignment editor say about that?
You know, Charles was fully supportive. I mean, he got it. I think, you know, he definitely wanted this piece. He saw it in a certain way. There's no way it would have been funded if it wasn't, you know, I mean, they flew me out there and paid for a hotel and things like that. It wouldn't have been funded if it wasn't something really fascinating to white people. And he got it. And that's, you know, one thing I really want to stress is part of the reason why this conversation has lasted as long as it has, part of the reason why we're just now 2 years in getting to these real questions and having people, you know, people are aghast and people are, I had no idea this is what it was, but I can see it so clearly. It's because we haven't really been able to get Black reporters and Black journalists in to meet with her. I can count like maybe three that I've seen total in the last 2 years. And if they are able to, it's for some sort of sensationalist piece. But the truth is that mainstream media has basically been sending in white journalists. And it's not to say that white journalists aren't good journalists, but they don't have the framework and the background and the knowledge about these issues from a Black perspective to ask these questions. That whole story, that whole side of the story has been missing. We've been talking about Black womanhood without Black women. And you know, we do that because I think it's comfortable. It's a framework that everyone can sit in a room. If you have a room full of white people deciding how the story's going to go, you don't know what you don't know. And I don't think people have realized that this whole piece of the conversation's been missing. Because the truth is that Black people are completely absent from the majority of writing rooms and editing rooms. And I was so fortunate that Charles asked me to do this, and I wouldn't have done it for any other editor. I wouldn't have worked with any other editor because I honestly didn't have to explain anything to him. I didn't have to say where I was coming from. In fact, he was able to edit in a way that brought me closer to what I meant than I was when I sent him the pieces. And I think that was really important because it was already such a stressful and emotional piece. I didn't have to explain anything or where it was coming from. And he fought for the piece. He fought for me and helped me more clearly state what I wanted. And it wouldn't have happened otherwise. But I really hope that other publishers who are looking at this piece, and I've had people reach out to me and ask if I will write for them and all of this, they're suddenly realizing I exist. If you're looking at this piece and wondering why this is the story that got a million views in 2 days and yours didn't, Look at your newsroom. Look at your editing room. You can't just bring in a black person when Beyonce does something interesting and have them write a piece and then send them back. We have very talented black writers who can't afford to stay writing because they are never hired for staff positions. They have no benefits. The pay is low. They're only brought in for these niche topics. We have no black editors in the room. So even if they are asked to write these pieces, their voices are muted and shifted away from their, you know, what they are actually trying to say. And so if you're looking at this and wondering why the response was so big, I think in part it's because people read an authentic piece on an issue about black women by a black woman and edited by a black editor. And people can recognize authenticity. And if you want that, you're going to have to change the way in which you report stories.
Rachel Dolezal is in your rearview mirror. Now what do we do? What are you looking forward to?
You know, I'm looking forward to people actually reaching out to black women and wondering what life is actually like for black women. There are so many amazing writers out there, and you just need to go find them. Get on Twitter. I mean, we all live on Twitter. It's one of the few places where I think black women have a chance to really build up a platform. But, you know, there's a lot of black women activists and writers who are out there every day. We've been doing the work for a long time. And if we look at like Imani Gandhi, Feminista Jones, find these voices. There are people who've been doing this for a very long time. And I really hope that people actually do that. You know, start, you know, pick up some Michelle Alexander books, you know, and really start learning about the system. And you will find the world will open up to you of ideas that you had never considered, experience you had never considered. And it's going to ring so true because it's going to be so authentic. And I really hope that people do that because we have been putting out so much work for so long. And all we really need is a little help to get it out to the masses. And we need platforms and we need the ability, we need people to share it, people who normally don't interact with that work. So I hope people do that because the answers are in there. Right now, we're in a state where this country is trying so hard to figure out the next steps, especially left liberal America, right? And they're saying, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? The truth is that black women have been saying what to do for so long. And that hasn't changed because what you're fearing right now, we've been suffering under for a very long time. So find their work. Listen to them. You know, the answers are there and it's been written beautifully. And you will be amazed. Like the world will make more sense to you. You will feel better. It's not easy reads, but you will feel better because suddenly you will have some answers for why things are the way they are.
Ijeoma Oluo wrote this piece for The Stranger. She's a writer and the editor at large for The Establishment. It's always good to talk with you, Ijeoma. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can read her piece on Rachel Dolezal on The Stranger's website, and we are tweeting out a link to it right now at KUOW.